Tip today in association with Slattery's of Pecan, your main Peugeot dealer for over 50 years in the Premier County. Slattery'sGarage.ie.
Good morning, and how are you on this rather cold morning? Hopefully we find you well. 1800-938-007, that's a free phone number, it won't cost you a cent. Lots happening on the programme today. Concerns being expressed that hospitals are not learning from mistakes which have fatal outcomes. The Rock of Cashel goes on tour in the UK. Our wine slot returns for the festive season, and Aravets in Tipperary Town urging you not to buy puppies for Christmas. I'm also joined in the studio in the final hour by a fantastic new singer-songwriter who has a great album out at the moment, and I'm looking forward to introducing her to you. Trudy Waters is producing today. She is by the phones right now to take your calls and your comments on 1800-938-007. You can text on 083-311-3311, and of course you can email Tip Today at tipfm.com at any time of the day or night. Now, we're still celebrating Pamela Scott's brand new store in Neenah. And we have a €50 voucher to give away again today. And of course, that prize is based on your interaction with us by text, joining in the conversations, or indeed coming up with something brand new. But do give me a full name and an address so that we can enter you properly into our competition. That text number again, 083-311-3311. Quick look at what's making headlines today. The Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, due to name the new Tánaiste later on today. It follows Tuesday's resignation of Francis Fitzgerald from that role. Plans for a primary care centre in Care have taken a major step forward. A planning application has been lodged for the development with Tipperary County Council. And efforts to reach a deal on the Irish border post-Brexit are set to intensify in the coming days. Father of five, Evan Morrissey from Nuin, died in Cork University Hospital on March 22nd, 2014, 20 days after his first presentation at South Tipperary General Hospital's emergency department, where he complained of a severe sudden onset headache, vomiting and neck pain. Now, this week, South Tipperary General has apologised and accepted responsibility for the death of the 28-year-old. However, solicitor for his partner, Gwen Bradley, and the family, Kian O'Carroll, says that while the apology referred to the drafting of a headache protocol as a result of this appalling breach of duty, it must be pointed out that there was a similar policy in place. And Solicitor Kian O'Carroll is with me in studio. Good morning to you, Kian. How
morning,
are you?
Good morning,
Fran. And thanks very much indeed for coming in to us today. Would you just fatten that out for me? Would you tell us Evan's story from the beginning?
Evan Morrissey was a 28-year-old man in an unusual situation, I suppose, for a 28-year-old, in that he was involved in a committed relationship and had taken on an almost unusual level of responsibility for a young man like that. He was very hardworking, and he had four children and a fifth on the way when he was suddenly struck with a violent headache, what's often referred to as a thunderclap type of headache, which was a pain that he'd never experienced before. On the 2nd of March 2014, he attended at South Tipperary General Hospital, and essentially the complaint is that it wasn't taken seriously. There was a protocol in place in A&E at the time, and that mandated doctors to go through a series of tests in order to outrule certain dreadful outcomes which these symptoms could represent. And if you deviate from those protocols or ignore those protocols, you run the risk then of being falsely reassured that the person is not suffering from something serious, such as a subarachnoid hemorrhage, which is a type of bleeding within the brain. And that, in fact, is what was happening, but at a very low and slow rate, such that it was causing symptoms of pain because of the expanding pressure within the skull. Evan was sent home, and the symptoms continued. When you've been reassured in an A&E unit, I suppose you're reluctant to go back very quickly.
Yes.
But he did on the 6th of March, went back complaining of very similar symptoms, not exactly the same, certainly the headache was there. There were complaints of dizziness and avoidance of bright light, photophobia as it's called, and a sense of nausea. So on the 6th of March, again, the same errors occurred. The protocol that did exist wasn't applied. On the third visit to the hospital, because the symptoms did persist, he returned on the 10th of March. And on that occasion, he was admitted. He was admitted for, I think it was 3 days. And during the course of that admission, the intention was to take the key step that would have resulted in a diagnosis. The protocol and medical understanding is that where you have symptoms like this, you perform a CT scan. But in 10% of cases, CT scans of the brain are falsely reassuring for a subarachnoid hemorrhage. And because that's known and because it's quite a high percentage, the instruction is that if you get a negative on the CT scan, you move to the next step, which is a lumbar puncture. That involves taking a small sample of the cerebrospinal fluid from your back, but it's all connected through the same sac or the dura all the way around your spine and up around your skull, your brain. As a consequence, if there is evidence of blood in the brain area, it will also show up from this sample.
Right.
That wasn't done. It was decided that it was to be done, but it wasn't. And he was discharged 3 days later with a diagnosis of migraine.
So that was just based on a clear CT scan, was it? Is that why he was allowed home at that point?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. It was decided that there was nothing sinister going on.
But the rest of the protocol was not followed.
Exactly. And all the way through on these three attendances, on each of the three occasions, the protocol required that a CT scan be done. And if the CT scan was negative, then you proceed to conduct this sample. But it wasn't done on any occasion.
So he was sent home again.
Sent home again. The symptoms continued. And then on the 18th of March, 2014, he was readmitted. But now things were much more serious. And what had happened at this stage was that the level of bleeding had either increased or the degree of bleeding had increased to the extent that the volume in the brain was now being compressed. Symptoms of loss of consciousness presented themselves. And he had a rapid descent after he was transferred to Cork University Hospital. So I should say that on that fourth occasion, the correct diagnosis was made because it was now very obvious on the CT scan. There was no need to perform a lumbar puncture. He was transferred to Cork, but it was too late.
In fact, he didn't die of that, though. Was it a cardiac arrest he actually died of in the end?
Yes, but we don't die from the compression of our brain as much as the effect that has on the other organs of the body. And so the compression of the brain resulted in a cardiac arrest.
These protocols were in place, but for some reason or other, South Tip General are now talking about putting protocols in place. But there were already rules and regulations there.
There were, and they weren't being applied. Throughout the four attendances that Evan had at South Tipperary General Hospital, he was seen by, I think, 11 doctors. And it was only at the very end, as I say, that a correct diagnosis was made. But at no stage was the protocol used. So that's 10 more junior doctors and a consultant, none of whom applied the appropriate protocol, which would have resulted in the diagnosis on the first occasion.
So the protocol is meaningless unless you follow through.
Correct. I think we can all have policies and protocols in our organisations. And unless it's applied and followed through with repeated training, instruction to new people being inducted into an organisation, monitoring to see that a protocol is being used and applied, some way of auditing that, well, then it's pointless. And to turn around, it's a bit like every crisis in the health service. The Department of Health comes out and commissions a new report or study, same for the Department of Justice. It looks like you're doing something. It sounds good. It's perhaps no more than a soundbite. But if it's not being followed through or implemented, it is meaningless.
Are you in any doubt, Cian, that if he was diagnosed early on maybe that first visit, that he'd still be alive?
Oh, there is no doubt that even if he was diagnosed on the second and third visit, he would still be alive. The expert opinion that was given to us on our side, and I must assume to the state claims agency who were defending the case on behalf of the health service was to that effect, because they made no contest on that point.
Right.
It was accepted.
And there was a complete apology, is that right?
There was a complete apology, right. And it was a very moving apology.
Yes.
In the High Court this week. It was given in a very meaningful way by senior counsel for the health service executive. And it was an apology which was written by the general manager of the hospital. So that, I think, is both important for the family and something that they will... It's something in writing that they will always have. There's a sense as well for, I think, families in a situation like this that it's important to bring the other side, to bring the hospital or the health service to the point of acknowledging the wrong they've done and the extent of the harm that they've done. And that written apology set that out quite well.
But following his death, Cian, what investigations happened? I mean, how did they look at what happened then? Did they go through everything that had gone down and come up with some sort of a comprehensive, profound investigation on it?
You'd imagine so. Mm. And the answer to that is no. Just to begin, before I even look at the hospital and what they did, when there is a death in a hospital, that death is reported to the local coroner. Evan died in Cork University Hospital, so that death was reported to the coroner for the City of Cork. And when we first became involved in this matter, it occurred, the first natural question you ask in this situation is, well, what's happening about the inquest? And we contacted the coroner's office and found out that there wasn't going to be an inquest because the death was reported as a normal a death within the hospital. There was nothing unusual about it.
Of a 28-year-old?
Of a 28-year-old, but what was more important was that the coroner had not been informed that this was a 28-year-old who had attended accident and emergency on the 2nd of March, the 6th of March and the 10th of March. Before, she was only told that he had attended Clonmel on the 18th of March and had been transferred to Cork, where he subsequently died. And that was hugely relevant information that hadn't been given to her. So after we provided that information, Dr. Mara Cullinan, who was then the coroner for the City of Cork, naturally acted immediately and required a full investigation into the matter. From a coroner's point of view. Now, a coroner's investigation requires statements from all of the relevant doctors involved in the care. And she builds up an understanding of what went on and decides whether to hold an inquest, which she did. By the time the inquest came around, just in March of this year, Dr. Cullinan had moved on. She's now, you'll see her in the news quite a bit for the City of Dublin. And the inquest took place. What came out at the inquest was perhaps the most chilling part of it. And that's where the clinical director for South Tipperary General Hospital confirmed to the inquest that there has never been a clinical review or investigation into this medical disaster at South Tipperary General Hospital. And when I asked him when would that take place, he indicated that there was no plan to hold such a clinical review.
Why?
Not even a review where doctors sit around a table and say, what did we do wrong here, lads? We have 10 junior doctors who clearly did not apply the protocol that we are talking about. They haven't done it. And they don't intend to. And they don't intend to because they have turned they have set themselves against learning from their mistakes. It's like wallowing in your ignorance. And the people suffering will obviously be the patients. And this all goes back to a complete lack of accountability.
But in a small business, if you had a plumbing issue that went wrong, management would get around the table and say, listen, what should we have done there? This is a man's life. I find that incredulous, Ken.
I haven't come across a situation like this before, but that's not to say that it isn't going on all the time, because of course we're not able to ask those questions normally. We're not in a situation normally where you find out what the outcome was. Interestingly, one of the witnesses, a consultant, and I won't name anyone in particular, but at the inquest, one of the witnesses, as he was being questioned by me, he seemed to think that there had been an investigation in the hospital that he had been a part of. And so I followed that line of questioning naturally because I was imagining, well, so there has been an investigation after all. No, it was simply his debriefing or briefing for the inquest. So the state and the hospital put a whole load of effort with lawyers into preparing everybody for their presentation of evidence at the inquest, but didn't spend a second figuring out what had gone wrong in their hospital that caused Evan Morrissey to die.
And just for clarity, What was their answer? Because I presume you put it to them why you didn't have this investigation. What was their answer to that?
I wasn't allowed to ask that question by the coroner.
Why?
It wasn't relevant.
What? But surely that is the most relevant question.
It did ask the question. The witness wasn't required to answer it.
That's incredible. So nothing has been learned from this tragedy, really, at the end of the day.
To be fair to the situation and the family, a lot has been learned in the sense that the state, as often has to be the case, have been brought kicking and screaming to the point of an apology. There's always something learned from it's a little bit like rubbing somebody's nose in it. The hospital management clearly know that they had to stand up in the High Court and make a very clear and humble apology for a death, which is, deaths occur all the time, but this situation is really extraordinary. Somebody so young, so much ahead of him, so many responsibilities in life, so much love around him in a big family, so many people harmed by it, that it is shocking when you see three separate opportunities missed. And that's why I think one of our experts in A&E medicine had commented that in his career, this was the worst case that he had ever come across because of the number of doctors involved making the same repeated mistake. To say that nothing has been learned, you have to hope. You have to be optimistic and hope that something will filter through.
I was reading Gwen's description of the pain that he went through at particular times, and one that almost made me emotional was outside of the cinema, where he was literally holding his head in his hands with the most awful, awful pain that we can't even imagine, I suppose, what the man was going through. For her and for the kids, I mean, it's just unthinkable, really, isn't it?
Yes, but they did everything they could.
Yeah.
And his GP did what he could.
Yeah.
Even the GP's letter of referral to the hospital, it was basically pointing out, this is what I think is going on here, gentlemen. But there is a pecking order, in a sense. The GP makes his referral to the hospital and the hospital takes over.
Of particular concern to the GP was when the pain seemed to go down his spine, halfway down his spine, which obviously alerted the GP that something sinister was going on here, but that didn't seem to trigger anything in the hospital.
And what came up, a lot of questioning at the inquest was around this. So individual doctors would have taken particular notes. So when you go to the hospital, every doctor you meet seems to begin at the beginning again and take a new history. And if the history with Dr. 3 is different to the history given with Dr. 1, perhaps because you've now received emergency pain relief and you're no longer experiencing those symptoms, or you've been given medicine to control your nausea and so you're no longer feeling nauseous. The fact that that Evan was then 4 hours later no longer feeling nauseous was cited as reassurance for the fact that he didn't have what are called red flag symptoms for increasing pressure within his brain. So you treat the symptoms, the underlying condition remains the same, and then you use that to discount the possibility of something more sinister. Whereas our expert said, no, each doctor in reaching a diagnosis must read back on the notes and find out what the symptoms were at relevant times, and in particular before those symptoms were treated. Otherwise, you cannot know what the underlying condition or illness may be. And it seems appallingly obvious, but doctor after doctor really applied that line of reasoning to say that, well, he didn't have those symptoms when I saw him, but he did. They're all in the records.
Absolutely incredible. What happens now where the hospital is concerned? I mean, are we talking about, I mean, they're talking about another set of protocols. Is that?
Well, yes, it's this protocol actually has an algorithm in it. So that's a step-by-step process. If A, do B. If B, do C. And it's very neat and easy to follow.
Again, this is specific for headaches, isn't it?
Yes, it's for acute sudden onset headaches.
Yes.
And the idea here is that this is a special type of headache. Does the person in the first place say that this is the worst headache they've ever had? Is it accompanied by certain red flag symptoms such as nausea, the photophobia, neurological symptoms coming down? All of those features are there. I should say that the new protocol that's there, while to my non-medical mind, it appears to me to be more difficult to follow than the one that was in place when Evan died. The one that was in place then was only available in the A&E department, and it was not available in their acute medical treatment room, which is the room to which he was brought on the third visit. So there is a distinction in a sense in that A&E saw Evan on visits 1 and 2 and ultimately 4, and they had the protocol, but that protocol was not in place in the room where he was treated on visit 3, whereas this new protocol is there. So that's the material difference. But it just, the family found it very, very hurtful to think that the hospital would then rest in an almost self-congratulatory manner on the fact that they had now introduced this protocol, and that the public would be reassured and think, oh, this is, everything is well again, and this couldn't happen once more at Salisbury General Hospital. And I think we can't take that reassurance.
Whenever we discuss South Tipperary General, or in fact the health service in general on the programme, we hear about the trials and tribulations of A&E, about how difficult it is. But it's we're always assured that once you get past A&E, that the care is top-notch. That doesn't come across from this, you know.
Well, Evan only got past A&E really on the third occasion, when he was admitted for a few days, and the test which was necessary and which was identified as being appropriate wasn't performed. There are problems in hospitals. There are problems of resources, but those problems are only compounded when people are doing their job in an environment where they're not going to be held accountable. If you come, you're doing a job here where you could do tremendous damage to yourself and to the organisation you work for if you make a mistake. And I'm the same. Now, neither of us can hurt somebody or kill somebody or take their life. Killing is perhaps too emotive a way of describing it. But to harm somebody in a physical manner, such as the world of medicine can, obviously inadvertently, nobody sets out to harm somebody. But if there isn't a sense of if there isn't an accountability there for the mistakes we make, well then I don't believe we're going to be as careful as we should be.
Was resources brought up as some sort of an excuse?
No, I don't think it was.
Was it not?
I don't think it was. And the accountability issue isn't addressed in something like a civil action. But remember that the consequences, apart from the consequences borne by Evan and his family, the only other consequences arising from this issue are for the taxpayer. The compensation, for example, the cost of the inquest, the cost of the civil proceedings, all of those are paid for by the state pension fund, which is administered by the National Treasury Management Agency. It doesn't come out of the HSE budget, and it doesn't come out of the hospital budget. And the doctors don't carry their own insurance because they're indemnified by the state. So it's not as if they now have to face a higher insurance premium next month or next year. They don't. And if there's no clinical investigation, well, then there can be no clinical finding against a doctor. And there are no disciplinary proceedings.
That's frightening.
That's the problem. The problem is we've designed a system where hospitals, where the health service executive, down to the regional administration, down to the hospital, down to the individual doctor, bears no consequence for poor practice.
Or accountability.
No accountability. There is a medical council there which can investigate complaints made against individual doctors. But those complaints would have to be brought by patients. Poor professional performance now must be made up of multiple complaints, not a single one, as a result of a Supreme Court judgment about 3 years ago.
So that can't be the case in Evan's case, then?
There is a proviso that if the individual, if the single event is of a very serious nature,
which of course
then it can amount to poor professional performance. But if you watch the reports from the Medical Council over the last 2 years, you'll notice that it tends to be multiple complainants coming through, and that's why individual complaints are not really dealt with anymore. But the Medical Council process, I've had plenty of experience of it, and it hasn't been good. So I don't think that that's a viable way to say that doctors are held accountable. Your manager needs to hold you accountable by a simple matter of, we've had a terrible outcome here, let's sit down and figure out what happened. Even if you're not going to punish or discipline people, it's not necessarily about, but learn from the mistake.
Where now? Where do you go now?
The case is finished.
Mm-hmm.
There is a separate aspect to the legal action which is continuing, and that's a judicial review that we've brought against the coroner for the City of Cork for the conduct of the inquest. And our argument is that the questioning at the inquest was narrowed to the extent that it prohibited a reasonable questioning of the doctors and a reasonable inquiry into the circumstances around Evan's death at the hospital. Right. For this reason, the role of an inquest is not to attribute blame or to exonerate anybody. The role of the inquest is to learn what the circumstances of the death were, who the person was who died, where they died, when they died. That kind of stuff is generally pretty obvious. But how they died, not just the medical certification of how they died, but the circumstances of death. And one of the main reasons set out for that is so that the jury can issue a rider or a set of recommendations as a consequence of their understanding of the death, from which society or certain organisations might learn.
But if they're not furnished with all of the information?
Precisely. And that's the purpose of the judicial review, to highlight this point, that because no individual doctor was allowed to be questioned on information that related to what another doctor had seen, as a consequence of that, the jury, by the way, I should say, is on that, the jury was never told that the state had admitted liability in this case. And the jury was not told that there was to be an apology in this case. So as the case ran before the jury at the inquest, they had no idea that there was anything untoward with the care that Evan Morrissey received. We were prohibited from calling independent doctors who would have been in a position to say, actually, no, we weren't treating Evan, but this is how it should have been done. And as a consequence, the jury, I think, up to perhaps if some of them saw the news reports this week, up to now they would have gone home with the clear view that nothing particularly untoward had happened. And that is the extent of the state's investigation. So that is wrong. That should not be the case. And so we're continuing that fight to make sure that something like this doesn't happen at an inquest again.
But obviously you will seek compensation.
Oh, that has been dealt with this week. And I can't say what the details were, but there was as good an outcome as could possibly be achieved for the family. Yeah. Because there are obviously enormous practical consequences from the loss of a father of five.
Of course, five children.
Breadwinner of the family. And while nothing can be done to fill the other obvious emotional gaps, something can be done to make a practical assistance to the family. And that was sorted out this week on Tuesday.
All right. But I'm not getting from you that you're assured that there is a learning process here and that going forward that things will be any better. Am I...
Well, improving the health service is...
Yeah.
I don't know what happens there, but I do know that while a system remains which is so clearly lacking in accountability, we are not going to see improved outcomes. And particularly where the HSE, I appreciate its budget is stretched, but if it continues to live in a world where the consequences of its mistakes have no effect on its budget, well then... that is going to contribute to an ongoing problem of poor quality in healthcare in Ireland.
All right, Cian, thanks very much indeed for coming in to us today. Cian O'Carroll there of Cian O'Carroll Solicitors in Cash.
Join the conversation in Tipperary. Contact us through Facebook, Twitter, or email tiptoday@tipfm.com.
Welcome back to Tip Today. Now Liz is online with me. Good morning to you, Liz.
Oh, good morning, Liz. Good morning, Fran.
You were listening.
I'm in a state of shock.
Are you? This is from hearing Evan Morrissey's story, is that right?
Yes, absolutely, because I too was a victim of a brain hemorrhage, which is what the man who died had.
Indeed, yeah.
And I'm just stunned. I've been taken on a vivid memory, as it was this same week as well, where years ago when I had the brain hemorrhage. And it's chilling. Absolutely chilling.
You were in the UK at the time of your brain hemorrhage, Liz. Is that right?
I was in the UK.
And what sort of experience did you have?
A violent headache. Horrendous noise of an aeroplane taking off in my head, and I was taken outside at the time to be given fresh air on a cold December frosty night, because the people didn't know what was wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
And paramedics were called and I was taken to hospital. Now I vaguely remember the paramedic saying, oh, okay, darling, you've got a migraine, darling, yeah? I vaguely remember that.
Okay.
And no more. And subsequently, I discovered that I had a lumbar puncture, which is protocol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, as the solicitor said, a CT scan could give a false assurance. So I had a lumbar puncture, and I was transferred to a neurological hospital in London the next day on mm-hmm. complete bed rest, and my parents were told she may or may not be here tomorrow. And then complete bed rest. I'm shocked to think of that poor, poor boy.
Yeah.
Being sent home.
Because I was saying to Keane O'Carroll there that I read some of what Gwen had to say in describing his symptoms and the pain that he was in and how it affected him and how he was holding his head. And in one case, he had to lie on the ground to try and get some relief from the pain. So I'm sure you're taken with all of that and it brings you back to that time. But you seem to have gotten very good treatment and pretty much immediate treatment.
Very much so, and I have to say, with what I know now about hospitals, I don't think I would be quite so lucky now with the state of the health service in the UK.
You think if a similar situation happened here,
if I had been taken to the local hospital and sent home again and go again and be sent home again, I mean, I'm surprised he survived as long as he did, really. I mean, a lumbar puncture would be the most obvious thing to do immediately. And I'm not even medically trained. I just cannot understand why this would not figure in any doctor's corpus of knowledge.
I mean, there was a protocol in place, but I mean, you can have all the protocols you want, I suppose, Liz, but if they're not followed, it's pretty meaningless, isn't it?
Well, I mean, maybe I've got the wrong take on this, but a protocol would be a way of working. But if one is a qualified and trained doctor, one would presuppose that a doctor would know signs and symptoms and work accordingly. Now, I take with extreme seriousness when anybody says they have a headache.
Yeah.
Rather than being totally reductionist and reducing it to the level of a headache or a migraine.
The saddest part of all of this is that if he was diagnosed properly on any of the three occasions, in fact, he'd still be with us. He'd still be with his five kids and with his partner, Gwen, you know.
Well, to be sent home with a slow bleed is frightening, absolutely frightening. Because I didn't have an operation for 3 weeks after, complete bed rest, no out of bed whatsoever, 3 weeks bed rest.
What fallout is there, by the way? I mean, have you any symptoms since, or how does that work, Liz?
Touch wood, I haven't. I was going to have physiotherapy and there was supposed to be a slight weakness in my arm, but there is no weakness. I won't say hale and hearty,
right.
But I'm living and only for that lumbar puncture. But I really don't understand the insertion of protocols, because if a doctor is trained and is an A&E doctor, I just cannot understand why your knowledge, aside and apart from protocols, that's like a training manual.
Have you any experience of the Irish health system?
No. No.
Okay. Well, thankfully,
a long, rocky road from rural Ireland to a hospital, to which there is no point going. If this is the situational reception of critically ill patients. It is scary. Scary.
And I know that you feel for the family, obviously, as well, who, I mean, you know, they're at the loss of Evan now and those young kids growing up without a dad? And by all accounts, he was a fantastic dad. He was absolutely brilliant with the kids. He just loved children. So, you know, what a loss. Trudy was also telling me that you were anxious to get in touch with us yesterday about something as well, Liz, were you?
Well, I was anxious to get in touch with you yesterday regarding the word disgusting and scary that were in common parlance during Maurice McCabe.
Mm.
And I have to say, the word disgusting was coined by the Commissioner Callanan, yeah?
Yeah.
Regarding Maurice McCabe.
Well, he got into a lot of trouble and he backtracked on that, but yeah.
That word, disgusting, should be applied to the treatment that poor man was meted at South Tipperary.
Yeah.
And what's even more disgusting is the carry-on of the HSE. And the situational circumstances regarding the inquest.
Yeah.
And I will be taking an extreme interest in the judicial review. And I feel compelled to visit Kian O'Carroll in Cashel and investigate more into this case, comparing it to my case. Because he should have been transferred to a neurological unit in a main hospital. Immediately after a lumbar puncture.
Yep. Immediately.
But to be sent home. 11 doctors.
Yeah.
One of whom was a consultant. That is so disgusting. It's unspeakable, unbearable to even conjure up the image of that poor boy being sent home. Aggravating and activating the bleed all the time he was moving around.
All right, Liz, well, listen.
But what I really wanted to say, you know, I was applying disgusting and scary within the context of the Maurice McCabe affair.
Mm.
But those two words are equally applicable to the HSC and the treatment meted to that poor family. But what I wanted to say was disgusting and scary.
Mm-hmm.
Maurice McCabe. It's still a related issue regarding the state accountability, as Kian O'Carroll mentioned this morning. The lack of accountability is unbelievable. It beggars belief. Alan Kelly was on yesterday, and I took your point, and I take your point, that Maurice McCabe, this has been going on for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
10 years. It's true that Alan Kelly was at the cabinet table before. He was.
Mm-hmm.
But then and again, and on the other hand, he did, with dignity, say he could not have done it on his own. He had Claire Daly, he had Mick Wallace, he had Katie Hannon, and he had John Burke of RTE.
Mm.
So he did have assistance, which he acknowledged.
Right, of course. And it was on that note, then, that I questioned him, because, like, it's not today nor yesterday that Mick Wallace and Claire Daly were speaking about this, and they were trying to highlight this while he was at the cabinet table. And that's the point that I made to him, and it was a pretty obvious point, I thought, but he was annoyed by it. But there you go, you know.
But he is right regarding scary.
Mm.
He is right regarding scary, because the time has come. That poor man, Maurice McCabe, and what he has gone through is unbelievable. And I'd just like to state that it's Kafkaesque. It's any citizen, you or me, that is effectively dumped by the state. Dumped.
Mm.
And we've all heard about Russia. We've all heard about Solzhenitsyn and going to the Gulag.
Yeah.
Oh, effectively, that's where Maurice McCabe was. In the Gulag, all on his own.
Well, certainly, if you were inside of an organisation and you did observe issues going on and you thought they should be highlighted, you'd be very careful about becoming a whistleblower when you see how that man was treated, but there you go. You know.
And as George Orwell said, when he was fighting in the Spanish Civil War, you don't shoot a man with his trousers down.
Indeed. Indeed. All right, Liz. And on that quote from George Orwell, we'll leave it. Good to talk to you today. Thank you.
Irish citizenship. We're a family of five and have been in Ireland for 14 years. Everyone in the family has already received citizenship except her. She had been waiting for 11 months. She so wanted to go to university this year, but I couldn't afford the 13,000 it would have cost as an international student. We've asked the help of local politicians and inquired ourselves to immigration regarding the delay, but every time we hit a brick wall. Please, Santa, bring some magic into her Christmas. Thank you, Mom Amanda.
Isn't that incredible that she is the only member of the family?
Strange, isn't it?
That didn't receive citizenship.
Yeah.
That is very, very odd.
I don't know the circumstances.
We'll have to try and find out a little bit more.
A little bit more about that. A couple of other stories. Nancy O'Mara got in touch to admonish a particular shop in Thurles that she went into. She said it provided her with her absolutely no customer service. She was in there. They didn't ask her, was she okay? Could they help her or anything like that? And she wonders, how on earth are they going to do business in the run-up to Christmas? So those are some of the texts coming in. Now, something else that's happening today, our wine slot is returning. So Gary Gubbins will be back in studio after 11, where you can sip. So basically this is going to focus on, you know, wines for your festive meals, whether it's for the turkey or if you're having goose, what you'll have for your entrees, whether it be
goose.
Lobster.
Did you ever have goose?
I did. I don't like goose.
Right. Is it like duck?
It's a bit. See, I'm not a big fan of fatty kind of foods. And I know I'll be killed for saying that goose is not fatty, but I'm a traditionalist. Mm. Even though goose is actually the tradition. So I'm a modern traditionalist.
No. Or something like
that. Or something along those lines.
One of the other things that struck us as very strange too that came out from the Kieran O'Carroll interview was that if a doctor is working for the HSE in a hospital like South Tip General, their insurance is not taken into account at all if they make a mistake. It's the taxpayer.
That's extraordinary, because in other countries, in the US for example, it's on the insurance of the consultants, but not here.
But wouldn't you imagine that if that were the case, there would be more accountability and somebody would be far more vigilant.
Absolutely, yeah. If it was coming out of their own pocket.
Anyway, very interesting. 1800 938 007. Thanks, Trudy.